Welcome to Occult Experiments in the Home, Magic, Spirituality and the Paranormal, in Personal Experience and in Practice. So, I was meditating the other day when all of a sudden I heard a voice, and with this voice came a very strong sense of presence. It felt like some sort of being was with me in the room. And this being seemed to occupy, for some reason, a particular position in space. It was to the right of me and slightly downwards of my line of vision, although I got my eyes shut at the time. And what this being said was, "Have you got anything to trade in exchange for intelligence?" And my instinctive reaction was that this was not something I wanted to get involved in. Whatever this thing was, it felt a bit shady, a bit desperate. And I think that's evident too in what it said. Have you got anything to trade for intelligence? I mean, if you're looking to do a deal with someone, then you wouldn't usually ask for anything in return for what you've got to offer, unless you were in a pretty desperate position. And this thing, whatever it wasn't asking for help. It wanted to enter into a relationship with me where it was hoping to obtain something from me. Experiences like this in meditation are fairly common, I think. In this episode, I'm going to explore the topic of possession and channeling in magic and present some thoughts about what I think is going on when we use these particular techniques in our workings, and also to share some experiences of my own and to talk a bit about the techniques that I use personally to obtain the states that seem to allow possession by an entity or facilitate a connection strong enough to channel it. And maybe it seems odd to start off with an experience like that one I just described. But I've chosen it because I think it's similar to something a lot of us may have experienced at one time or another. And it's the kind of experience, maybe, that really points to what we're trying to arrive at when we use possession or channeling. What we're trying to arrive at is an experience of something within our mental field of awareness presenting itself to us in a way that is very much distinct from the everyday experience of self. For most people, most of the time, we go around and there's stuff arising in our mental field and we attribute it to ourselves. We see it as our experience of ourselves. But what we're aiming for in a possession ritual or a channeling state is for something to enter into our mental field that is other, that we definitely cannot attribute to our usual sense of self. And immediately, perhaps, these kind of experiences flag up one of the potential dangers when we're using possession and channeling as techniques. Namely, the risk of over-engagement, let's say. So there's something in our mental field that presents as not us. And the more credence we lend it, the bigger the space it will occupy in our reality, running the risk that we might get a bit crowded out by it. To give another example, once, years ago, I was meditating and this little yellow blob popped up and said hello to me. And I decided to ignore it. And then it started to explain to me, "Oh, it's all right, it's okay, I'm an old friend of yours. We used to know each other really well, but one day I reached a level of attainment where I had the opportunity to enter into another dimension. And the price of going into that other dimension was that I've been removed from your history, so no one in your reality now remembers me. But, you know, we can reconnect." Now, if I'd decided to buy into that narrative, that would have opened up all kinds of cans of worms containing alternative realities and false memories. And no doubt this yellow blobby thing would have wanted me to do X, Y, and Z for it. And it's easy to see how these sorts of experiences can lead into psychotic episodes. If we ascribe reality to entities like this, and more importantly, I think, then start to take actions on the basis of this, then we can run into serious problems, and it can be difficult to find our way back. Normal psychological functioning tends to rely on experiencing the mental field as our own, rather than sharing it with something other than ourselves. For the purposes of our magical working, we may want to allow something like that for a time, but we need to be able to come back from it and to return to the experience of the mental field as ours. And so the general advice, I think, is always to hold these sorts of experiences quite lightly. Lacan's formula for psychosis is, what is excised from the symbolic will return in the real. And I think that's relevant here. These sorts of experiences, if we don't reserve a little bit of a symbolic attitude towards them, taking a step back and thinking, well, you know, this is just an experience, it's interesting, it's evocative of something. If we don't do that, then we are indeed excising the symbolic dimension of the experience and therefore giving the entity full reign to take over the real, our reality, our whole mental field. So the sorts of experiences I've talked about so far have been transient, spontaneous ones. But if we're aiming for possession by an entity, or to channel an entity, then we're coming at it intentionally. And instead of something just coming into us, what we're trying to do instead is to open up and invite something to come and share our mental field of awareness. So how do we do that? Well, I think in all sorts of strange ways, we're actually doing it all of the time. There's a paper by Freud that he didn't quite live long enough to finish called The Splitting of the Ego in the Process of Defense. And in this paper, he describes a kind of mental mechanism that he'd only just noticed and seemed to be quite excited about, although it was really left to the analysts who came after him to really pick it up and run with it. And today, this fundamental assumption that the ego can split itself into different parts is a real cornerstone of modern therapeutic approaches to psychological trauma, for instance. In this paper of his, Freud presents a case history. It concerns a 4-year-old boy who is sexually abused by an older girl. Freud describes how the boy dealt with this by developing a sexual fetish that stayed with him into later life. Now, you might be thinking at this point, you know, what the hell does any of this have to do with magic and possession and channeling? But bear with me. One of the brilliant things about Freud is he has this knack for showing us how what seem to be features of really disturbed and pathological states of mind are also often present in everyday experiences. And what Freud felt he'd discovered through that little boy's experience and his formation of a sexual fetish was a splitting of the boy's ego into two distinct parts. One part carries the terror and the injury of the trauma that he experienced, but the other part is a kind of triumphant part, a joyful part that takes pleasure in the experience because of the fetish that has been formed. Freud's most famous, of course, for his concept of repression. So in repression, something horrible or disturbing happens and we just push it out of awareness. When we repress something, in effect, we hide it from ourselves. But this is not what's happening here. The fetish, somewhat frustratingly, Freud doesn't say what the fetish actually was, but the boy's fetish actually links back to the trauma he experienced and yet provides a means of deriving pleasure from that experience. To get our heads around this, maybe it's easier just to think about kink and BDSM practices in general. Often these practices involve pain, sometimes very significant amounts of pain, and fear and upset. But these are in a context where pleasure is derived from them. That's the aim. The context is one of intention and, of course, consent. It often strikes me that this kind of splitting is more effective than repression, because splitting our ego as a response to something awful happening means we sort of get to have things both ways. I'm not suggesting, of course, that all members of the BDSM community are doing what they do as a means to deal with past trauma, of course not. But what they're doing does reflect a unique facet of the human mind, I think, that it can encompass extreme contradictions by holding them apart from each other. On the one hand, real and extreme physical pain, and on the other hand, real and extreme sexual pleasure. There are other common cultural manifestations of this splitting, perhaps. Another one is irony. We split our ego into two when we use irony. One part of us is saying something literal, and at the same time, another part of us is expressing something completely contrary to that. Another example is the tacky, the camp, which is a kind of aesthetic expression of splitting. The delight we take in things that are so bad that they're good. Part of us recognises the genuine badness of whatever it is that we're looking at, even whilst another part of us takes extreme delight in it and appreciates it for what it is. And probably the most socially acceptable form of splitting is humour. In humour, we take a step back from ourselves, laugh at ourselves. In that moment, we're inhabiting two selves at once. We're the version of ourselves that's on the floor suffering, and at the same time, we're inhabiting another version of ourselves that can look down at the one on the floor and recognise their absurdity. Strictly speaking, humour is not a splitting of the ego, it's the split between the ego and the superego, which is probably why it meets with social approval. But the principle of the human mind so readily dividing itself into contradictory parts puts it in the same category of mental phenomena, I think. Splitting as a means of defence seems a lot more attractive than boring old repression. But there is a downside to all these forms of splitting that I've mentioned. If we split up our mental field into parts, then there's the possibility of one of these assuming dominance. So a potential difficulty with BDSM practices, for instance, is that we could conceivably reach a point where we couldn't achieve sexual satisfaction if our partner didn't embody some sort of fetish or some sort of role. Likewise, if we overindulge the tacky and the camp, then we run the risk of losing the ability to discriminate between what really is good and bad. And humour and irony, they can both go too far. They can both tip over into becoming ways of disengaging from reality rather than coping with it. And if we've experienced severe psychological trauma, then split off parts that might be carrying feelings such as shame or fear, they can persist, they can hang around. And indeed, that is the main feature of conditions such as PTSD or complex trauma. When a part may be becoming unruly, it can be helpful to look at not so much what that part contains or presents, but what it's trying to do. That's useful in a therapeutic context. In the magical context of possession and channeling, I think we need to flip that around. And if part of the mental field that we've intentionally opened up to some sort of entity seems to be becoming unruly, then we have to remind ourselves of what our intention is, what our purpose is in doing that. If we've decided to channel Baphomet, that's presumably not because we want Baphomet to take over the rest of our lives, but because we want to obtain some kind of communication or benefit from their presence. Reminders of the function, the purpose, the intention of the part can be useful to help reintegrate us and ground us. So what I'm suggesting here is that when we do possession or channeling work, we want to create a split in ourselves. We want to make a part of ourselves available for something and for that something to come in and inhabit the part of us that we've offered. We want to have an experience of something in our mental field being inhabited by something that we don't identify as being a completely integrated part of ourselves. And that might sound rather daunting at first, but like I hope I've illustrated, splitting is something that can be part of ordinary mental functioning, like humour and irony. And indeed, it's important to bring a light touch to this at times, to not allow the split-off part to acquire too much reality or substance. Otherwise, it might assume a kind of dominance that can lead us off into the more psychotic end of things. Splitting can be a perfectly normal part of mental life, but that said, if we've experienced psychological trauma through our lives, then this may be something that we tend to resort to more quickly and more deeply than people who haven't had those sorts of experiences. In my experience, people who've had trauma in their lives and do this kind of work, they may discover that they're really good at it and able to obtain more profound and satisfying results than other people. But they might also be inclined more readily to run into difficulties with this kind of work because of that. As ever, this stuff is risky, and I don't recommend it to anyone. But if you've had trauma in your life and you decide to do these practices, then look after yourself, be prepared. And if things get intense, like I was suggesting earlier, it's important to keep your eye on your intention, your purpose in undertaking this work. That's why you're doing it. That's what comes first, and not the interests or desires of any entity that might come and occupy that part of you that you've offered up. If your intention and interest is not being met through what you're doing, then it's time to say thank you very much and shut things down, step away. I don't claim to have any particular talent in this area, but it is a kind of magical work that I've experienced and found intriguing and have enjoyed because it's so direct and so intense and the results can be quite startling and dramatic. The tradition of Western magic that I've been involved in, of course, is chaos magic. And in that context, you can take a really empty-handed approach to possession and channeling work. I've done rituals where it's pretty much been just a room and a crowd of people and putting a bag over my head and seeing what happens, inviting an entity to come in and just see what happens. But I'm aware that there are traditions such as Voodoo and Santeria that have this kind of work very much in the centre of their spiritual practice and rituals. And very probably people far more talented and experienced than me are involved in those sorts of traditions. So, imagine the scene. There you are. You're in the middle of a circle full of people. And you've got the bag on your head, the bag of art. And everybody in the room is getting expectant and excited. And now you've got to bear the manifestation of the entity you've chosen to allow to manifest through your mind and body. How are you going to do that? I've never done a ritual involving work of this type without, in that moment, feeling acutely embarrassed and a sense that either nothing's going to happen and I'm going to look a complete idiot, or on the other hand, something is going to happen and I'm going to look a complete idiot. But the conclusion I've come to now over the years is that having these sorts of feelings is okay and perhaps a sign that we're on the right track. If we're feeling shame and embarrassment, then that's a sign that we're focusing in on our sense of self. We're having an acute experience of ourselves as an object, an entity that's open, exposed, available to whatever's going on in that moment. And given that what we're aiming to do is to open up a part of ourselves and allow something to come into that, then that's probably exactly the sort of state that we need to be in, that we need to be cultivating. Shame and embarrassment are both states of splitting. One part is standing outside ourselves and treating the other part as this abject, vulnerable object. And that potentially is the part into which the entity will come and manifest. So shame and embarrassment are actually good signs that we're on the right track. And the danger here would be perhaps to shy away from that, to try to shut that down, to come back into ourselves and close up. That might feel like a more secure place socially to be in, but you're more likely to end up having to fake it if you stay in that place, rather than remaining on the safe side of shame and embarrassment. What we want to do is kind of really go into that and get to the other side of it. Get to the point where we've stepped into those feelings of shame and embarrassment so fully that we don't care anymore. We just don't care. If we can get into that space, then we're really open and something beyond the ordinary has greater capacity to enter. The form that seems to work in my experience is with a group of people. The person who's going to bear the manifestation is set aside, and they and the rest of the group are involved in some sort of group ritual designed to summon the entity. And this provides a context in which there's a sense of increasing energy and the imminent arrival of a point in time where that energy will reach some sort of climax and the entity in that moment will be due to appear. Or not. Down the years, what I've found myself doing and what seems to work for me is to have the bag over my head or be blindfolded in some way so I can't see what's going on and be distracted by it, but can at the same time hear and sense the building energy that's going on in the ritual around me. And what I'll usually do during this time is practice Breath of Fire. You'll be able to find instructions online for this if you haven't come across it before, but it's a very paradoxical form of breathing. On the surface, it's intense and energetic, but contrary to appearance, it's actually a calming, relaxing breath. It's actually a very long, slow breath that's being expressed in very short kind of digital intervals. That's my way of describing it anyway. And at the same time as I'm doing Breath of Fire, what I'll usually do is put myself into some sort of stress position, typically just holding my hands up over my head with the palms together, a position that will become more uncomfortable and challenging over time and create a bit of stress and discomfort. And also, to add to all of that, I'll generally contract my pelvic floor muscles while all of that's going on. So overall bodily, there's a build-up of tension. But underneath it all, like I was saying, the breath of fire is a very slow, relaxing breath. So it's a paradoxical state, and that continues as the ritual, the energy builds around me in the room. And finally, the climax of the ritual comes when the entity is due to appear. And then I drop all of it. I just let all of it go. Let go of all that tension all at once, immediately, and relax. And hopefully into that state of relaxation following all that tension, hopefully something will enter. And I don't think we can escape it. There is an unavoidable sexual analogy to this process, I think. It's maybe like the creation of an equivalent to the post-coital state. There's been a mounting sense of energy and excitation, all of it building to a point of climax, a particular moment where literally we're waiting for the entity to come. And then all that tension is released, let go of. And that post-coital, post-orgasmic state, or at least the analogy of it that we are maybe recreating, that too is a state in which we are open and vulnerable, maybe, and often more prone to intimacy and connection than ordinarily. It's kind of like the shame and embarrassment that we noted earlier, in that we're open, vulnerable. But hopefully we're on the other side of that at this point, and there's more a sense of connection and intimacy. If we're in a actual post-coital state and we're experiencing shame and embarrassment, then that's probably a sure sign that the connection has been missed, that it has failed to develop. But hopefully, in a ritual setting, at this point, where we find ourselves is being in an open and vulnerable state, but in a more relaxed and quiescent way than at the beginning. One part of ourselves is now looking at another part of ourselves that has just let go of a lot of tension and is now in a moment where it's open, blank, empty, waiting. And so there's that opportunity for whatever entity we've chosen to allow to inhabit this cleared and available part of us to now manifest. And I have to say that having reached this point numerous times with many different entities and on many different types of ritual occasions, I have never, ever not found myself thinking, oh crap, nothing's happened, what am I going to do now? That thought has always been floating about somewhere or other whenever I've reached that point. People with more talent for possession and channeling than myself maybe don't have that to wrestle with. But for me, it's always a case of doing that thing that we often find ourselves having to do in magic, perhaps, which is just to remind ourselves just to trust that what we've arrived at in the magical working is the result, the just and proper result. Whatever we're experiencing in that moment is the result we were striving for, whether or not we're actually able to recognize it as such at the time. The first ever possession ritual that I did, there were only two other people present, and I think I hardly recognized that that's what it was when I did it at the time. It was a invocation of the Archangel Uriel, which I found in a old grimoire, A.E. Waite's Book of Ceremonial Magic, which was a collection of mostly 18th century spells. And I adapted the ritual from that, which involved summoning the Archangel Uriel into a glass of water and then drinking the water with the intention that the Archangel then comes into the body. And right from the beginning, I remember I was using the breath of fire and the stress technique. That seems to have been something that I just did instinctively right from the start. And the results, well, pretty much straight after drinking the water with the Archangel in it, I started spouting out all these strange words in a strange language and was taken surprise by the force and the energy of this, as I think were the two people I did the ritual with. It happened so quickly and suddenly that we didn't manage to get a full recording of the words, but we got some of them, and with a bit of twisting, there seemed to be a message in there that was mostly Enochian, but had bits of English in it as well. But it didn't seem to have led to anything massively significant at the time. The one thing I did note in my journal after the working was the slightly unexpected vibe I got from the Archangel, which felt somehow vast and huge, but at the same time kind of impersonal and slightly mechanistic. And that's a quality that I found again and again when dealing with archangelic entities, and something that I noticed subsequently that many other magicians had remarked upon. The possession state in that working, the message received, it was all quite short-lived and quickly fizzled out. And I didn't know it at the time, but it would be many years before I came back to that kind of direct possession whereby the entity kind of speaks directly through the body. Mostly what I ended up doing in the years that followed was something more akin to channeling rather than possession. How I'd describe the difference between the two is that when we're channeling, we're obtaining a message, a communication from the entity concerned. Whereas when we're doing possession work, there may again be a message or a communication, but there's also a sense of presence, as if the entity itself is present in the body of the person doing the working. And also I think that sense of presence being an important part of the ritual itself. We get possessed by something when we want that entity to be physically present with us, and we channel something when it's primarily information or a message from that entity that we're seeking to obtain. One reason why you might want to channel an entity rather than just do some sort of straight up divination is that the entity supposedly has access to knowledge or has abilities to access information that we ourselves don't. And I've done a number of workings along these lines in a group where I'd stick the bag over my head and invite some angelic or Enochian entity to come forwards and relay to me messages for members of the group that wanted them. I'm not particularly psychic myself, but I could get quite striking results from channeling an entity that had these abilities. And then there were the workings that I did with my erstwhile magical partner, Alan Chapman. I channeled a spirit who announced himself as a representative of the Great White Brotherhood of Enlightened Souls called Tempe. And I bring that up here to really reflect upon how my experience of this sort of work has changed and evolved over the years. When we started off working with Tempe, I would sit and go into a meditative trance and give over part of my awareness to Tempe to allow a message, a communication to form. And this would often occur in a very indirect kind of way. So I might have a feeling, which might be an emotion or a physical sensation. And I'd just let my attention dwell on that and see where that might want to go, how it might want to develop or move. Or sometimes it might be a mental image or a stray thought that might arise. And then again, I'd just give that some attention and see what it wanted to turn into, maybe, or what might proceed from it. So Alan would ask Tempe a question, and then I'd just sit and see what arose in response to that question, and I might have like a mental image of a snail or something. And then we would try to decipher what that might mean in the context of it being a supposed answer to the question. And this often felt laborious, difficult. It often seemed as if the entity were having to work against something in order to get some kind of message through. And then, of course, there was the constant sense that Alan and I were having to interpret what was being given to us. It wasn't direct. It was often easy to assume that I was just having random experiences that we were trying to bend into some sort of meaningful message. But at the same time, we couldn't completely ignore how a lot of the things that came through seemed to make sense. And some of the messages were prophetic, supposedly about things that would happen in the future. There was one part where I seemed to be getting numbers that seemed to be some sort of geographical coordinates. Alan at the time was planning to go travelling around the world, and these coordinates did seem to have an uncanny relationship to some of the places Alan went and how they featured in the awakening experiences he had when he was travelling. But one of the little incidents that really stayed with me was a moment when I was sitting in one part of the room with my eyes closed in trance, and Alan was sitting a distance away. And suddenly into my mind popped the sequence of numbers 555, which I just said out loud as soon as I received it. And I heard Alan gasp and swear. And later on he explained that he'd just happened in that moment to glance at the clock, which I couldn't see. And just at the moment he'd noticed the time was 5:55, I had come out with the words 555. And that really conveyed in a very direct, vivid way that Tempe was present and could maybe see what was going on in the room and also have access to what Alan was experiencing in that moment. So that whole working for me, that experience of channeling, on the one hand it kind of felt foggy, indirect, not quite real a lot of the time, as if maybe it was just self-delusion. But that was all mixed in with also a real sense at times that there was something actually there that was struggling to get a message across to us, with some amazing glimmers of veridical information coming through from time to time. So I think it was about 3 years ago now that Alan got in touch, and of course he's been developing his own philosophical system during the decade since we did the Tempe workings. And he'd had a vision in which Tempe had appeared and revealed his true identity to Alan as the Greek god Aeon, the god of unbounded time. Alan felt this was significant, and he asked me if I'd be willing to channel Tempe or Aeon or whatever it was that might have wanted to convey a message. But it had been 10 years since we'd last done any magical work together, and the last attempts that we'd made together to contact certain entities had been oddly unsuccessful. And as well as all of this, I remembered how difficult it had felt trying to communicate with Tempe, how vague and indirect a lot of the communications had been. So at the place where Alan and I met to do this work, it just so happened there was a group of people and somebody there who had a real gift for entity work, who could really go into deep trance states and come out of them and not have any memory of what had happened, which is often taken as a sign that a genuine full possession has taken place. That's something that I personally have never experienced. During possession and channeling work, there's always a part of me that's aware of what's going on, and I can't claim that I've ever lost consciousness of myself during one of these workings. So I persuaded Alan that the best contact would probably be achieved if this person in the group took the role of medium. But unfortunately, as it happened, things took a very dark and difficult turn, and perhaps in large part due to some unfortunate personal dynamics at the time, what manifested through this person was a demonic entity, something that was very far removed from Tempe or Aeon or any kind of god, it seemed. So after we'd banished that as best we could, it looked like it would fall on me again to do the channeling. But I was surprised to discover that in the intervening years, something had changed. I sat down and one of the members of the group did a hypnotic induction, so I was in a hypnotic trance. And I began to feel a certain energy, a certain vibe. There's a song called Bat Wings by the band Coil, and the energy, the presence, the vibe that I felt reminded me of the opening lines of that song. Something about the tone of John Balance's vocals in those opening lines, the cadences. And then all of a sudden out of this, Aeon started to speak. It wasn't images or mental impressions that needed some kind of interpretation. It was words coming directly from the entity. And first of all, he seemed to offer some symbols, saying things like, "The scarab plunges into the water." And then, a bit later on, starting to speak as I, the entity itself, speaking directly through me to the people there. So a form of channeling this time that was very much closer than in the Tempe workings to a possession. The god speaking as if the god himself were present among us in the room. But that didn't mean to say that those feelings I mentioned earlier, the shame, the embarrassment, that feeling of panic at the climax of the evocation when it feels like nothing has happened, all of that was still there. Something I was amazed by, however, has been in my work as a therapist, coming across people with presentations that fit the criteria of dissociative identity disorder, or DID. Once upon a time, DID was referred to as MPD, or multiple personality disorder, but that's a term that tends not to be used these days. The first time I experienced someone whose experience of themselves is as a collection of different personalities changing from one of those personalities to another, I was really taken aback. The body language changed, the posture changed, the voice changed, but also there was a shift in that just that sense of presence that you have being in the company of somebody, that sense of who they are, that shifted too. And it just felt like somebody different was sitting there in front of me. With clients who fit this kind of presentation, you're never quite sure who's going to turn up for the session or who might be making an appearance in the session as it proceeds. And as you become more familiar with the different personalities that inhabit that person, you get to a point where you can tell just from stepping into the waiting room and seeing the body language of the person sitting there and feeling the presence of them, who it is that's decided to come along to the session that day. But I think that only comes after developing a certain degree of familiarity, whereas I could tell over time who'd turned up that day. The reception staff seemed oblivious to the fact that although ostensibly the same person was turning up at the same time each week, they had different body language, different tone of voice, different accents, a different presence altogether from how they might have been the week before. I think it was these kinds of experiences and observations, more than any other, that led me to the conclusion that channeling and possession has something to do with the propensity of the human mind to be able to split and divide itself. And like I suggested earlier, although this tendency might be more marked in some people than in others, nevertheless, I think it's a function that we all have and we all utilise to some degree. We're all of us, to some degree, I think, a collection of sub-personalities which we've evolved over time as a response to, you know, the trials and tribulations of our lives. In my personal therapy recently, we did some work on mapping my own system of internal personalities, and I've got the list of them here. There seem to be about 7 of them in total. Some of them fairly common, fairly orthodox, I think. There's a young part that's very dependent and clingy, and then there's an angry toddler that pushes people and things away. And either of those can become a dominant part in me, I think, if I'm under pressure. And I think many other people probably have similar parts. But some of them, to my surprise, are a bit more exotic and strange. There's one that takes the form of a giant moth, and it lives on the moon. It's generally solitary and silent, and wise, very wise. And it's secretive, and you can never pin it down. But off on the moon, it lives in its palace of wonders, although, of course, it is alone. And then there's another part that I call Steer Pike, after the character in the Mervyn Peake Gormenghast novels. Steer Pike is a late teenager, who dresses all in black and is very pale. And he's cynical and ruthless and intensely critical. He likes to rip things down and pick things to bits. And he can be insulting and callous at times. And then there's another one that's like a kind of giant fetus that floats, or perhaps more like the ghost of a fetus, because this is a subpersonality that feels that it isn't real. It doesn't feel real or grounded, and it's constantly searching for a body so that it can become real, but it can never find one. It's quite blank and empty and ghostly and dissociated from everything. And then there's another one which I call the armoured dwarf. He's like a tiny, squat man who wears black armour all over his body and a visor like a knight. And what he sees as his function is to block the light that comes from the heart. In the heart there's pure golden light, but the armoured dwarf stands in the way of that, prevents it being released fully out into the world. Everybody hates the armoured dwarf. he's an outcast, he's deplorable. But part of his nature is that he doesn't care that he's hated. It's a bad thing that he does, and he knows it, and he understands that people hate him. But he does it anyway. He blocks the light from the heart because that's where he stands, that's where he finds himself, and that's what he regards his function as being, whether he likes it or not. And I imagine that if you're listening to this and you're somebody who happens to know me personally, you might well recognise some of those parts I've described. You might well have met them, especially if you see me under stress or in some state of excitement or other. So that's a little glimpse into my system of sub-personalities, my multiple personalities. Because every personality, I think, is actually a kind of collection. And so just being ourselves is, from this perspective, actually a kind of possession. We're always channeling something, it could be said. Take care, my lovely. May all your parts be safe. And we'll speak again next time. Bye-bye.